Welcome to the Clever Cookster, your ultimate window into the kitchens of the world's best cooks.
We've all been there. You're listening to a podcast on the go when you hear a super interesting ad for a product or service, but simply don't have the time to check it out. Well, now you're in luck. See the full list of offers, discounts, and more from our Quick and Dirty advertisers over at quickanddirtytips.com/offers. That's quickanddirtytips.com/offers.
Our guest today is Autumn Giles, the gluten-free green market enthusiast and poet behind the blog Autumn Makes and Does. She's working on her first cookbook, Beyond Canning, New Ideas for Preserving, Pickling, and Fermenting. Today, Autumn's joining the Clever Cookster to talk about making great food that just happens to be gluten-free. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I know that you're really passionate about cooking seasonally, cooking from the farmer's market, thinking about using a lot of different kinds of ingredients. But you sort of think about cooking gluten-free food almost as an afterthought. Like it's always really delicious, but just happens to be without gluten.
Yeah, definitely. I've been, just for like a little history of myself and gluten-free, I have celiac disease and I've been gluten-free or needed to be gluten-free for, I guess, like 10 years ago, I was diagnosed. And for me, and this definitely isn't everyone's, you know, path, but needing to be gluten-free ended up being kind of such a blessing for me because it really forced me to learn how to cook and be a good home cook and be resourceful. And I found that the best gluten-free stuff that you cook is usually the stuff that doesn't need to be designated, I guess, as gluten-free.
So you kind of avoid the idea of substituting with gluten-free ingredients or compromising on flavor by just sort of tackling things that don't even require those substitution.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie, I love to bake and there's really no way around gluten-free flours, right? And then those are a substitution, but I found really the most exciting times to me are ones that I can explore a dish like carnitas, for example. I eat meat. I got really into making carnitas. And, you know, there's nothing in there that has gluten in it. And so like trying different recipes and figuring out which one I like best. And it turned out amazing every time. It was something that you could serve to your friends and not have to feel like, oh, well, I'm making you this thing. I had to, you know, subtract this and this and this sure. Because to make it gluten-free. But yeah, I mean, they're so, I feel like it's so much easier to approach gluten-free cooking, to just approach it as cooking, you know, when you have a knowledge of the things you can't eat and really look at the things that you can eat. And I think that is definitely a trend in the larger gluten-free cooking and eating world that I'm happy to see.
So talk us through a typical day for you. What's breakfast? What are snacks? What are the menu items that you count as go-tos that you revisit again and again?
Sure. I eat oatmeal for breakfast almost every day. And I'm not a sweet breakfast person. I mean, I love sweets, but if I eat something sweet in the first thing in the morning, I will turn into a zombie. So I eat gluten-free oats. And some folks with celiac disease, I should say, like can't tolerate gluten-free oats, but gluten-free oats are okay for me. So I eat gluten-free oatmeal. And I put tamari, which is just like soy sauce, but gluten-free, and sriracha on my oats, sometimes an egg. And that's really, it sounds boring, but that's really like an every morning thing for me.
Yeah, that sounds really good.
It's so good. And I used to bring it to work when I was working in an office. Still, I work from home now. I'd bring it to work and I'd bring it to work in a mason jar and people would, I think, kind of like smell it and look at it. And it looks a little gross. It's, you know, just brown. But then people would ask about it and I would tell them. And I think I got a lot of people hooked on the savory oats because with just like soy sauce or tamari, sriracha, it's really good. And it's a quick savory breakfast, like a lot of quick breakfast can be sweet sometimes.
It's kind of like congee, like the savory rice
bread. It really is. And I actually cook my oats. I like them. A lot of people don't like this, right? They like to not stir them that much and keep them kind of chewy. But I like mine like a little more mushy, like congee. So I do add like a little extra water to my oats, and it's very congee-like. It's very delicious. And so for lunches, since I work from home, I have the privilege of sometimes cooking my lunch if I have time, if my schedule works out that way. And I mean, this time of year, I've been doing a lot of just roasting. I love Brussels sprouts. So I'll buy like a big bag of Brussels sprouts that are like prepped at Costco, and just quarter them and toss them with a little bit of olive oil on a sheet pan and just roast them. And when they're almost done, I'll throw in like chickpeas or whatever leftover protein I have just to kind of heat them up, kind of add whatever I have in the fridge for flavor. I've had lemons, a lot of lemons lately. So I'll put like a little zest on there. And I usually, instead of like sour cream, I buy a full fat Greek yogurt, and I use that kind of as sour cream as a topping on lots of stuff. Snacks. Well, so I'm working on my book now, and I've been working on a lot of fermenting recipes. And I found that when you want a kind of like salty snack, fermented foods are such a good option because they're ready there in your fridge, and you know, they're not a chip. Not that chips aren't okay sometimes, but
yeah. So I want to talk a bit about the cookbook. You're sort of taking the idea of preserving, canning, pickling, fermenting foods, and trying to make it accessible for a generation of people that maybe didn't grow up knowing how to do it.
Yeah, definitely. There are a ton of preserving books out there that cover the basics awesomely. So I'm trying to really go the next step in this book and, you know, bring some like new flavors and textures, that kind of thing in. And my approach to preserving is really kind of trying to demystify it a bit and think of it more as another tool for the home cook. And it's awesome to be the person, and I am that person who, you know, wants to order a case of tomatoes and spend a whole weekend preserving those tomatoes. However, that isn't the only type of preserver that you can be. You can like literally fall in love with one thing. You know, like I live in a rural area now, and I used to really love, when I lived in New York, buying mother-in-law's kimchi. It's so delicious. And it was like one of my favorite splurges. But now I live somewhere where it's not available, and there aren't a lot of those type of products available in the stores in my town. So I've already started making that. And if, you know, you're someone who falls in love with a product and maybe just like every year you buy a ton of cabbage and you make kimchi, you know, you can be that kind of preserver as well. There's just so many, I feel like, different avenues, right? When we think of preserving, we think of making a ton of strawberry jam or something, but you know, you can infuse alcohol, you can make shrubs, you can pickle things for the fridge, that sort of thing. And it's a great way to make your everyday meals more interesting, and particularly like the leaner meals like rice and beans or the leftovers, to help make those meals more exciting.
What are some of the secret ingredients that you think everyone should have in their kitchen, whether they're gluten-free or not, or just trying to eat more healthily and give themselves more options? What are your go-to secret ingredients?
That's a really good question. Secret ingredients. I mean, tamari, like I mentioned with the oatmeal, is one for me. Even if you see, and I don't entirely remember the taste of soy sauce. I know that sounds crazy, but like I couldn't tell you like the nuances between like soy sauce and tamari. My understanding is that tamari has like a slightly more complex flavor. Could be wrong about that. But
no, I always think of it as being a little bit earthier. It has that deepness or nuttiness. There is a complexity that's different than the soy sauce you would get in a packet.
So tamari is awesome. And so even if you're not a gluten-free person, you can then serve it to your gluten-free friends without any problem. And one of my big must-have ingredients, and this came out of, you know, getting into preserving, is preserved lemons. And there's something, and this is a thing that really attracts me to preserving is like preserved lemons, totally expensive to buy, really cost prohibitive in a lot of cases. Like these things are like $8 for a very small jar. And all they are is lemons and salt, right? So they're so easy to make. You literally just cut open the lemons, pour in the salt, smush them in a jar, let them sit. And for me, that is a must-have ingredient that I make every year. You can use Meyer lemons, you know, a little bit more mild, but you can also use, you know, like now that I live in Arizona, I have this absurd experience of people like bringing me like shopping bags of citrus fruit. Just like, here, take it, take it. That is like from their backyard. And so I've gotten a lot of lemons that way this year. And I made preserved lemons out of the, you know, thicker skinned, more like gnarly lemons too. And they literally like make anything better. I really think so. They don't have quite the same like funky, like kimchi. They don't have that funky sourness, but they have definitely a sourness that's not just the lemon sourness. And because you put them in salt, they're salty. And they have a textural component as well, because as the lemons sit, their rind softens. And so it kind of adds a bit of chewiness as well to whatever you're using them in. And I know people will cut them up and put them in relishes, or I put them in grain salads. You can use them in, you know, like on roast meats or tofu. They really just kind of have the sour, salty, kind of funky, all that delicious stuff.
That's a really good one. I hadn't thought about preserved lemons. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I wish everyone would make them because they're so easy to make and they make everything so much better and they're very, very expensive to buy.
What do you think are some fears that people have about preserving or canning, or some moments where they feel really intimidated, and how do you encourage them to get over it?
Sure. I mean, of course there are like food safety fears, right? And I think that's probably the first thing that most people think of, you know, the big, vague fear of, am I going to make someone sick or hurt them with this food that I'm making? There's a really, really phenomenal preserving book called Saving the Season by Kevin West. It's a gorgeous book, and I'm going to misquote him, so I won't really quote him, but you know, he says something like, if you can prepare chicken and follow the proper safety precautions for preparing chicken, you can something. And so that is, I really like that, because I think that kind of puts it into perspective. But people are so much more comfortable and familiar with preparing something like chicken that it's just something they don't, you know, even really think about. I've had a lot of fun experimenting with the fermented recipes, because I think that's the other thing that, you know, the element of intimidation that comes into preserving is, you, if you're a cook that doesn't normally follow a recipe, which I'm kind of not, I will admit it. The having to, you know, follow, like if you're vinegar pickling, right? Something like green beans, you really need to follow the directions. But for something like fermenting, I think it's unique because there is definitely room to play around and still make safe recipes. I think the other intimidation factor can be equipment, and you really don't. You can get started with a stock pot, some jars. You do kind of need a jar lifter for, you know, for making jams and pickles. Jar lifter is a thing that, so you don't have to wrangle jars out of boiling water with your hands or something else. But I think when you're starting on a smaller batch level, I think people are surprised by how little equipment maybe they need. And that's especially true for fermenting as well.
Well, I'm really looking forward to your book, which comes out in 2016. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. February 2016.
Awesome. Thank you so much for these tips. They're super helpful. For more ideas, look forward to Autumn's book, Beyond Canning, New Ideas for Preserving, Pickling, and Fermenting. And join us next time on The Clever Cookster for more tips and tricks from the kitchens of the world's best cooks.